book.
Never mind the retirees. I went down to the room. Oh, sure, I was downstairs at the cafe before I got something from them. Is that your LA?
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. And I understand that, Regina, do we have we been given a 30-minute warning about being on the floor?
It's 4 o'clock.
Yes, at 4 o'clock. So we'll start, and then when somebody will pay attention, and when the bills start to ding, we'll just recess and go up there. And I'm sure it won't take any time at all, and then we'll just come back here and finish the rest of our agenda. So let's see who's here. We have Senator Latz. Oh, Senator Latz, you're always present and ready to go.
You should be on the committee.
I think we strongly encouraged him, and he resisted.
Chairs by his table.
Senator Latz, Senate File 3070.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This is kind of an update piece of legislation. When people have custodial accounts, if they are the custodian, and they have to pay the bills for someone that they're taking care of, they can write a check or they can go pay cash. But unlike most of us, when we pay our bills, they don't have the statutory authority to use a credit card or debit card or electronic transfer. So this statutory update would make that change, allowing them to use debit or credit cards to make payments from the accounts. With me here today is Robert McLeod from the Minnesota State Bar Association, of the Probate and Trust Section. He's also a partner and chair of the Estate and Trust Department at Lindquist & Venom Law Firm.
Mr. McLeod, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's Robert McLeod, McLeod. And again, I am appearing on behalf of the Probate and Trust Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. And I view this as a very simple change to the statute, to update the statute to accommodate the current trends in activity with banking law. Basically, the check is going by the way of the dinosaur, and this is allowing debit cards and similar debit transactions to take place with a custodial account. A custodial account, as you probably know, is a bank account to hold money for minors, usually persons under 18 or 21. And it simply allows debit and credit card activity with such an account, which is the future and the trend of the banking industry.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure, but I'll direct this to the Senator. What I've noticed here in a recent newspaper indicating serious problems with conservators and others, indicating there's no protection for the owner. There's much misuse of credit cards now, and it seemed to me that you might have something in your bill that can deal with something like that.
Senator Latz, does your bill deal with conservatorship and
No, Madam Chair, Senator Foley, the bill does not specifically deal with conservatorship. It simply deals with the mechanism of utilizing the funds from the account. There are other venues, I think, for addressing those other problems, including issues of oversight, but that's not the subject of this bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, I think, though, that you should be thinking about how that can be rectified before you give any more additional authority to any of the parties involved. I am very uncomfortable to hear or read about situations where the party has lost all their money and their house and other kinds of things, and the courts have not monitored that in a proper manner. And your legislation, it seemed to me, I'd like to have you add something if you can get some wording on that.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, it's been so many years since I've had UCC law that probably what I learned then isn't even relevant anymore because things have changed so much. But I'm wondering, when we're dealing with a trust account, and so we have fiduciary responsibilities and we have concerns, a lot of times these are minors' accounts, and if somebody writes a check, I'm thinking of situations where the checkbook is stolen or the credit card is stolen or the debit card is stolen. If somebody writes a check or steals a check and it's a checkbook and writes a fraudulent check, that's not going to ultimately result in a loss to that account. And the same thing, I think, would be true of a credit card. If a credit card is stolen, I think the responsibility is going to come to the person ultimately that accepted that credit card charge if it was a stolen credit card and it was fraudulent. But I think the rules are different for debit cards, and maybe someone can enlighten me on that. I think the rule is that if someone uses a debit card, that even when it's fraudulently used, if it's a stolen debit card, you lose the money. And maybe I'm wrong about that, but again, this is certainly not my area of expertise. But I think there's a difference between how checks and credit cards are treated and debit cards, and that's something we should maybe think about.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I don't have the answer to that question. I hope Mr. McLeod has some thoughts on it.
Mr. McLeod?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, quickly stated, I don't know the official, debit card protection that certain banking institutions might offer, but the fiduciary, as the Senator pointed out, is responsible for all the transactions that take place and can and probably would be held personally and financially responsible for any improper use of the account that takes place under their watch.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, so that would be true even if the credit, if it were a debit card that was stolen through no fault of the fiduciary's, the fiduciary would still be responsible for that, you think, under existing law?
Mr. McLeod.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, by and large, the quick answer is that is left to the sound discretion of the judge. There would be facts and circumstances to weigh in any such a situation, I believe. But quite simply, this bill would not eliminate fraud, and there have been issues related to fraud, but nothing new. This particular bill does not make fraud any easier or improper conduct of a fiduciary any easier, but it does address the very realistic state of affairs that debit cards are becoming the standard in banking practice.
The same fiduciary duties that apply in circumstances of a check or other funds are applicable now to debit and credit card usage.
Madam Chair, that is absolutely correct. The fiduciary duties are waived in no way whatsoever. So in other words, if a fiduciary is in a situation that they assess that debit cards are not prudent with this person, then the debit card should not be given. It's just that simple. And if they give a debit card when it shouldn't be given, they would be held liable, called a surcharge.
Any other questions for Senator Latz or Mr. McLeod? Is there anybody here in the audience who is here to testify against this bill? See none. Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 3070 be recommended to pass and be referred to Senate floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam
Chair, Mr. McLeod. Thank you, Senator Latz. Senator Pretner Solon. I think I saw her come in. Oh, there she is.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's good to see you. Madam Chair, I'll start right away if you wish, because I know we're going in session any minute. This bill is a technical follow-up to a platting recodification bill I carried last year for the Minnesota Society of Professional Land Surveyors. They represent 650 public and private licensed surveyors across the state of Minnesota. Similar to last year's bill, the MSPS, Minnesota Society of Professional Land Surveyors, has asked for input from all organizations it worked with last year on proposed changes, and that's the League of Minnesota Cities, the Bar Association, townships, and Minnesota counties, and they have not expressed any objection to this bill. So the first change can be found in Section 1K and Section 2, Subdivision 8, where we are clarifying the definition of a water boundary and stating that wetland lines should be dashed. It is standard practice to draft all lot, block, and exterior plat boundary lines on the plat with solid lines to make them stand out visually and to clearly indicate that these lines represent property boundary lines. When property being platted abuts a wetland, such as river or lake, the shoreline of the river or the lake typically forms a water boundary. This water boundary is also an exterior boundary line of the plat, and therefore the shoreline is drafted with a solid line. In many instances, other types of wetlands, such as ponds, creeks, streams, drainage ditches, or swamps, are situated all or partially within the boundary of the plat. The shore or margin of these wetlands typically do not form lot, block, or exterior plat boundaries, and often cross over lot, block, and exterior plat boundary lines. Prior to August 1st of 2007, in the statute revision, it was standard practice to draft the shore or margin of this type of wetland with a dashed line. Drafting these wetland lines with a dashed line makes them appear less prominent than property boundary lines and creates a visual distinction between this type of wetland line and plat property boundary lines. This also creates a visual distinction between this type of wetland line and the shore of wetlands such as rivers or lakes, which constitute a plat water boundary. So to summarize, it is important to utilize one line type to represent the shore of wetlands which form a plat boundary, and a differing line type to represent the shore or margin of wetlands which do not form a plat boundary. Okay. So revisions to the statute, which took effect August 1st, 2007, inadvertently required the shore or margin of all wetlands to be shown with a solid line. This resulted in the inability to graphically distinguish between wetlands which form a property boundary of or within a plat and those which do not, and that is why we are proposing these changes. The next change can be found in Subdivision 10 and is a clarification of monumenting plat corners. The current language requires monuments to be set at angle and curve points on the outside boundary of the plat prior to recording, and requires interior block, lot, and witness monuments to be set within 1 year after recording the plat.
Oh my gosh.
The current language contains no requirement for monumenting corners on the outside plat boundary that are not at angle or curve points, and contains no requirement for monumenting outlot corners, and this change corrects this situation. Section 4 is a technical change. It revises the coordinate values in statute to allow for the use of U.S. survey feet. With the delay in adopting the metric system as a standard for measurement in the land surveying community, as well as the U.S. society in general, expressing coordinate values in U.S. survey feet is standard practice. This revision to the statute will bring standard practice into compliance with the statute. And the final change is in Section 508.47 and 508A.47. And these are being revised to achieve consistent media size and type to mirror the changes we made in last year's regulations. Last session, media size and type requirements for registered land surveys were changed to reflect updated standards, technologies, and processes. Because we didn't cross-reference registered lands, hardships and inconveniences has occurred for these parties responsible for the preparation, review, recording, and storage of registered land surveys. Existing statute also contains outdated language in regard to elevation references, certification of taxes paid, etc. These changes conform registered land surveys to appropriate media size and type. So that is a walk through the bill, and I have with me Michael Welling, who is the Washington County Surveyor, and Lynn Caswell, Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors, who can really answer questions about the details of these if you have some.
Yeah. Mr. Welling?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Michael Welling.
And are you going to testify or are you just going to answer questions?
I am just here to answer questions.
Any questions then for Senator Partner Solon or Mr. Welling or Mr. Caswell?
Madam Chair, I might say that this has been a long process of updating the statutes over time, and this might be the last one, do you think? Maybe not. This has been the third time we've been through this process since I've been here.
Well, as much as it appears to be foreign language all on its own, you know, this is very important stuff where a single word or you know, mismarked line on a map could make a big difference. And so this is very important work, and I'm glad that you are all working with Senator Partner Solon to make this all come together. If there are no questions for Senator Partner Solon or the two testifiers, is there anybody in the audience who's here to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none, Senator Olson moves that Senate File 2936 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both.
Yes.
Senator Betzel?
Sure.
Yes, we're going to go to Senate File 3067.
Oh, it's 4 o'clock.
Oh, it's 4 o'clock.
Oh,
they haven't.
They haven't rang the bell.
It's the House. The House squeaks. I mean, the other body squeaks.
Wow.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first thing I'd like to do is address the A1 amendment. This is not technically an author's amendment since this bill has already been passed by one other committee unanimously. But really what this does, it doesn't make any substantive changes. All it does is just put the it rearranges the language so that it's clearer and easier to understand. And I know that Ms. Pontius worked on this and has assured me that there really aren't any substantive changes here. What this bill does, and I'm going to try to say this very quickly so that we can have Secretary Ritchie make a few comments, and just want to say how much I appreciate his interest in this subject. Basically, we're trying to do something for those who are helping our war effort in the Guards, in the active duty military, or are working on behalf of the war effort, so that if they're not able to pay, there's a total cost to the state, I think, of $900 for doing this. But there are 70 or 80 people a year who are caught in this circumstance, and we can do this small thing to help them out. And with that, I'll turn it over to Secretary Ritchie.
Thank
Mr. Mark. Secretary, welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Mark Ritchie, Secretary of State. Very quickly, 70 or 80 individuals serving our nation each year get caught up in kind of a paperwork snafu where they don't, because they are otherwise occupied, get their paperwork in time. This simply allows us to reinstate a revoked business or other filing without cost to them. Again, we estimate it right around $900, which would affect the general fund. That's why there's a note attached. But we think this is a very small cost to take another worry off the shoulders of those serving our country. Thank you again for this opportunity to speak before you today.
Very good. Members, I'm going to have Ms. Pontius just walk us through the A1 amendment so that we – and then we can talk about it, because the vote on the A1 amendment to put it on the bill will be the bill. So, Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair and members, this really is just a technical rewrite of the bill. One of the things that we had flagged when it was introduced was that it used some terms that weren't really defined. It talks about a Minnesota business entity, and it uses the term a principal of the entity. Well, those aren't defined terms under the general statutes. So I worked with Burt Black in the Secretary of State's office, and he came up with some suggestions for language. There was actually an oral amendment in the Ag Committee, but they didn't have time to address it and just send it to Judiciary to clean the language up, basically. So that's what the amendment does, and then it just restructures the sentence a little bit to make it more readable.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed that both the title of the bill and then the headnote on of A1 Amendment A1 Line 3 refers to returning combat veterans, and there are many military members who are deployed, but they're not necessarily sent to a combat zone. As an example, they may be sent to the Army Hospital in Landstuhl, Germany. They're still deployed, but they're not in combat. So I think, you know, the head note, I think, does not actually reflect the language of the bill, because it talks about, number one would be in the armed forces. The second one does talk about essential for the prosecution of war, but line one does not. So I think the more proper term would be returning military veterans in both the title and the head note. Whether they see combat or not, if they're deployed and they're gone for a while, it comes back, it shouldn't matter, you know, whether they're in combat or not.
Senator Olson, is that the intent?
That's correct, Madam Chair, and if Senator Betzold wants to make that motion, I'd consider that a friendly amendment to the amendment.
Well, Madam Chair, I think Senator Olson can probably incorporate
it. Just incorporate it.
Or incorporate that into
the amendment. And then the title would be amended accordingly.
Senator Olson will incorporate that into her A1 amendment. Is there are there any questions for Secretary Mark Ritchie? Are there any more questions for Senator Olson on the bill, on the A1 amendment as amended or as incorporated? Senator Olson moves the A1 amendment. Any further discussions? Is anybody here to – actually, why don't we do this? If there are people here who wish to testify – we're under call. So if there are people here who wish to testify on the bill, is there anybody here who's going to testify for or against this bill? Okay, see none. Senator Pearsall, is it a big issue or a small question?
It's just a question on line 113. And I see the word employment is used there. Is that better than deployment in this particular case? Or I don't know who to ask that of.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Yes, it has to say employment, not deployment, because this is referring to people who are not in the military but are part of the war effort.
I looked at that and I thought so, but I wanted to be sure.
Any other questions for Senator Olson on the A1 amendment? Senator Olson moves the A1 amendment. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Olson moves that Senate File 3067, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. And the Judiciary Committee is in recess.
Thank you very much.
We will announce it on the floor. Senate Judiciary Committee is back to order. Senator Betzold, Senate File 3085.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 3085 is an amendment to the Uniform Probate Code that's been presented by the Minnesota State Bar Association. And before we proceed, there is one very technical amendment I'd like to move as an author's amendment to the bill. If you look on page 2, line 27, you'll see the word abate, after word abate, put the word first.
Are we talking the A1 amendment?
No, not the A1 amendment. This is the bill.
The bill? On page 2, line which?
This is the bill, page 2, line 7. It says section 524.2-603 or 524.2604 to a decedent or such a child, comma, abate first, and then the comma would be there, as otherwise, at insert otherwise provided in section 524. And I'll explain what that means in a minute, but basically it sets up a priority so that if you have to reduce the estate, the children get their share first before other people do. That's the intent of that amendment. And that's just something that was caught that needs to be inserted in the bill here. So I'll move that as an author's amendment, and then I'll proceed with the rest of the bill.
On Senator Betzel's amendment, as an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape he would like it to be in, any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
And Madam Chair, as I indicated, this bill is a probate, uniform probate
code amendment, and going through the bill here, I'll explain the sections, and we have a witness here who can go into greater detail on it. Section 1 deals with some changes that were made to the probate code about 10 years ago, and then a rather unusual situation came up under which the current law, as it's read, actually caused an unusual result in a tax situation where you had a husband and wife that had made out their wills. The husband and wife divorced, and the husband remarried. And they created some trust as part of their wills. Now, under normal situations, we would have assumed that the husband would have provided for his second wife, even though she was not mentioned in the will, because when he made out his will, he was still married to his first wife. However, that's not the way that the Internal Revenue Service read the will. They said that because he did not, in creating this trust, because he did not specify his second wife at all, she's out. She just basically gets virtually nothing under the will. And that seems contrary to what the intent normally you would provide for your afterborn children. You may, if you're married and you're divorced, we assume that you did not want your spouse in there. But the assumption would have seemed to have been to have actually provided for the spouse. So Section 1 actually takes care of that. Now, if there's a prenuptial agreement where there's not going to be provision for the spouse, or there's some other exceptions where the spouse is actually excluded the will, that's fine. But unless those steps are taken, I guess the legal presumption would be that there was an intention to provide for the spouse who became the spouse after the will was written. And as I say, then the amendment that we just adopted just clarifies that section, that if we do have some devices under the will and you haven't got enough to go around, then the children would be taken care of first. And I think that's what people think. You know, you provide for the children first before you provide for others. So that's what Section 1 does. In Section 2, we do have an existing portion of the probate code that provides that if you've got homestead property, it can transfer as a homestead, and it provides for in the law. But what some people are doing right now is creating trusts for the descendants and for beneficiaries. And the amendment in Section 2 basically says that by creating a trust of the homestead classification would still be the homestead classification. It doesn't lose that classification just because you created a trust. But some people are doing it, and they lose that classification. Section 3 is more of a clarification on the notice that must be given to the Minnesota Department of Human Services if somebody has been receiving assistance. And because they have a claim against the estate, if assistance has been given, it isn't right now. However, you just treat DHS as just another creditor. This provides more information that has to be provided to DHS in order to make that notice to them, so that they actually know what's going on. That section also provides that the personal representative of the estate has to make a reasonably diligent search for creditors. Right now, the personal representative is required to give notice to any creditors of the decedent, but the personal representative can probably get by just saying, well, I don't know if there are any. You know, just doesn't have to do anything. There's actually an affirmative duty, really, to open the mail, to go looking to see if there's any bills owed by the decedent, to make sure that the bills are paid, because they are entitled to reimbursement and being paid from the estate. And then Section 4, starting on page 7, is really just more cleanup language, because when a lot of the amendments were made in 1989, just some of the language just is not needed anymore, and that takes care of that. I do have a witness here from the Bar Association. I'll defer to her for any further comments.
Is it Ms. Sharon?
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Mary Sharon. I'm the chair of the Legislation Committee for the Probate and Trust section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. I'm also the chair of my section in my law firm, Best and Flanagan in Minneapolis. We think these are very good amendments. My committee has worked hard and long in an attempt to create legislation that we think better reflects what the people of Minnesota would want, particularly with respect to this omitted spouse language. We 10 years ago, as the senator said, the law was changed, and the presumption was at that time flipped from assuming that if you died with an old will in place or didn't make your will in time for your new spouse, that you would want to disinherit your spouse. We had this occur in a couple of situations and agreed very strongly in the committee that most people would have the opposite presumption, that they would assume that their second spouse would at least take an intestate share, which is a larger share. The bill leaves in place the provisions that allow for someone to intentionally disinherit a spouse if that is what they wish to do, but they'd have to go do that. So we think it creates a more fair and better reflective statement of what we think Minnesota citizens would want.
Thank you. Any questions for either Ms. Sharon or Senator Betzel? Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, what does devise mean?
Ms. Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, it means to give. When you write a will, you say to give, devise, or bequeath. If you want to split hairs, devising technically means leaving real estate, but it's used as a generic term for I give you something under a will.
Thank
today.
You.
Any other questions for either Senator Betzel or Ms. Sharon? Is there anybody else here in the audience who wish to testify either for or against this bill? Senator Schein.
Madam Chair, I have an A1 amendment. I believe that Senator Betzel knows about it. Ms. Pontius.
Is this one?
Did it? I did want to.
Senator Scheid on the A1 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair. I don't have my notes or anything from my office about this, but I believe that 149A is funeral director's statute, so it's incorporating language from the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act that we passed last year and having it conform to the funeral director's language. And then 525A is the Anatomical Gift Act, and there are language changes there. There are no policy changes. I do want to ask Ms. Pontius if she thinks on 2.3 and 3.10, did we need to say we've added person in the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, and then we're conforming over in 149A. Do we want to say the person or persons who were acting as the guardians? Because prior, you know, we'd used the word guardians last year because we were talking about persons. But now we're adding a single person. Does it, I mean, and maybe it's fine. As I read it, it looked a little funny to me, though. What do you think? Can I just ask for an opinion?
It's
what you think?
It's closest to that.
Senator Higgins has just given
Senator Higgins,
me the grammar
why don't you speak louder
lesson
into the record.
That I needed, and what she said was that you go with whether the singular or plural is closer to the to the noun. So, goodness.
Because otherwise here. You could do the guardian here. Or guardians, take and that's
a little boring. So, with having said that, and if Senator Betzel looks at it, I think he knows
what it
does.
Senator Scheid, I know that we did quite a bit of work last year on the Anatomical Gift Act. Is this amending what we did?
Madam Chair, there's some language changes, like person as well as persons, which we did last year, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And but it's trying to conform what we did last year with what is in the funeral director's language in 149. If you need more explanation, I can have somebody from LifeSource explain to you why they need to do this. I think that would be helpful, perhaps, to the committee.
And Senator Scheid, how come, or is this a separate bill that's moving on its own somewhere?
Well, Madam Chair, it's a separate bill that I have, and I don't know that it's not moving anyplace else. It would have come here. And I believe
yep.
that
Well, Madam Chair, I've got a copy that's provided to me. Senator Scheid introduced Senate File 3371. I don't know the date that it was introduced, but it probably would have been introduced the last week or so, I guess, by its number, and it was apparently referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Well, Senator Betzel, as the author of your bill, I guess you could provide some direction to the committee on whether or not you want this amendment on the bill.
Madam Chair, I've reviewed it, and certainly if Senator Scheid wants to provide testimony, I think this adds clarification to it. The only note of caution I would have would be the fact that there was not really public notice that this, because it was introduced as a bill and here it's being amended on something else. And at this stage of the session, of course, everybody's trying to do stuff like that, and we have to be quite careful of it. I don't know if Senator Scheid had anybody contacting or with any issues or concerns, but I don't know that there's anybody who would have known if we amended here instead of the floor. But I don't find anything in there that raises any concerns for me, except, again, we just got to be cautious on the procedure that we're following here.
And Senator Scheid, I'm hesitating for that, and I hope you understand. I just want to make sure that the members understand that if something is already a bill, we will try to give it a hearing. Now that we're hitting crunch time, I don't want to get into the pattern of trying to put bills into other bills. So that's the position that I will take, and if members of the committee wish to go in another direction, obviously, I mean, we work as a committee, but I'm a little bit concerned about that.
Madam Senator Scheid. May I ask the witness to speak to this, if you may, so you don't understand what's in it?
Sure.
Obviously.
Hi, Madam Chair. My name is Susan Ma Larson, and I'm with LifeSource. This is actually language that was suggested by the Bar Association, but I can speak to what it does. I think Senator Scheid said it well, but what it really does is take a section of the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act and the Funeral Directors Act and make sure that they're consistent so that when a family's making decisions after death, that it's the same person making the decision. So that's really all it does. I don't think it's a major change.
And Ms. Mallard, I understand that, but I hope you understand my concern, which is that I think it's a very good bill, and it's already been introduced, and it's now in the committee. I'm concerned that we have a bill that has something to do with wills, and we're taking a different bill and trying to merge two bills together. My inclination would be that perhaps we give, now that we've already heard on this bill, that we give an opportunity for this bill to come to the committee and send it on its own, apart from this bill. I just want to not get into the practice of taking a bill that's already on its way here and putting it into another bill in the committee. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I know that I always have a lot of questions on anatomical gift laws and bills as we debate them. And the question that I have is I know nothing about Funeral Director Act and how that merges or reflects an anatomical gift procedure. I'm a little uncomfortable in
Madam Chair,
even voting on this.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'm withdrawing the amendment, and I will say, however, that we wanted it to conform. There's a certain amount of sense it makes to conform what funeral directors should do when there's an organ donor, for example, and they need to know the priority of who can make those decisions, and I think a funeral director would need to know those, as well as medical examiners, which I think we did last year in the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. So, but that's the rationale, but I'm withdrawing the amendment.
Senator Parasol, Senator Scheid has withdrawn the A1 amendment.
But to the point that she just made, I wondered if that meant that would be absent anybody having already gotten that permission to be the person. So you're still trying to choose a person, that's right? Is that correct?
Madam Chair. For,
with the right to make a decision on behalf of the decedent.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair. This has to do with who may make the gift. And we did that last year. And we did it in a priority listing. And this replicates that in the funeral director's statute so that they have direction and don't have to wonder what to do. I think, you know, it's a little out of context for me, and I'm embarrassed because I'm not prepared to do this today. I didn't think it was going to come today.
Well, so. You know, Senator Scheid, obviously members of the committee have an interest in this, in your bill.
Right.
And so, we'll make the time. And Ms. Mahler, I hope you'll come back and answer questions and give us more information on the bill. We did a lot of work on the anatomical gift bill last year. And to the extent that we need to do something to make it in conformity, I think that would be a priority. So, thank you for withdrawing the amendment, and we'll bring the bill to the committee. Thank you. Any other discussion on Senator Betzel's Senate File 3085?
Madam Chair, I don't know that the bill has to go anywhere else. I have not been so informed. So I'll move that Senate File 3085, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
On Senator Betzel's motion, any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Scheid.
Yes. Madam Chair and members, I think I'm better prepared for this bill. So, did you wish me that I would start? And
yes, Senator Scheid.
Okay, Madam Chair, this is a Uniform Act proposal, a proposal for a Uniform Act, and Senate File 1406 is. And I think in current law, we have, it was passed back in 1972, the Uniform Management of Institutional Funds Act. So it was UMIFA. This is UPMIFA. This is a Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act. It would replace the 1972 law. So I'm not sure that we approved it in 72.
Yes.
We did. Minnesota did adopt it. 47 jurisdictions have enacted that, the first one. And now we are, that's what, about 36 years ago. So what this does is, and I have experts to talk about the technical aspects of it, but I want to tell you generally that it provides guidance and gives authority to charitable organizations concerning their management and the investment of funds that they hold, that those charitable organizations hold. And it imposes duties on those who manage and invest charitable funds. And the idea is to provide additional protections for the charities and also protect the interests of the people who make the donations to the charity, who want to see that the contributions that they make are used wisely and for the purpose that they intend. So it's modernizing the rules. It updates certain provisions I think I will have people. Mr. Hainsworth, are you probably going to speak first, or Mr.
I'll speak first.
Okay. I have witnesses, and I think I'll let them give you more detail. I could say more, but I think he will be more specific.
Is it Mr. Hainsworth or is it Mr. Mullen?
I'll speak first, Madam Chair. Harry Hainsworth of Council of Briggs & Morgan and a Commissioner of Uniform State Laws. Mr. James Morgan. James Mullen is from the Catholic Community Foundation, and he would be speaking as someone who has to work with endowment funds and therefore has had to apply the existing statute, and will have to apply the new statute.
I can be very brief in summarizing. The new act was just approved in 2006. It was adopted in 14 states last year and has been introduced into 17 additional states, including Minnesota, this year. And it will be very widely adopted. Secondly, the accounting profession has just promulgated a draft of accounting standards that track this new act and make those standards applicable to all charitable organizations with endowment funds effective for fiscal years ending after June 15th, 2008. So those are going to apply even in states that do not even adopt UPMIFA. So in other words, this is a national, clearly a national trend, and clearly is going to be the standards that are going to be applied. Since Minnesota adopted the original act, I passed out in the materials, or included in the materials, something called a quick comparison, and it's a two-page handout. If you look at that, since Minnesota adopted UMIFA almost verbatim, and if you look at comparison of UPMIFA and UMIFA, you can see that basically it doesn't alter the law so much as it does simply modify it, strengthen it, give more guidance and more standards that need to be applied. And that's essentially the nuts and bolts of it. And so from that point of view, it's really a modernization. It replaces but modernizes but does not change substantially the substance of law with respect to that topic.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Hainsworth. Mr. Mullen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm the investment officer for the Catholic Community Foundation, an organization I founded in 1992 and served as its first president through the end of 2004. And I retired at that time, and in my dotage, I served part-time as the investment officer. So I still am immersed in this statute and what it's meant for us. I'm here to encourage the adoption of UPMIFA. We think that is an improvement on the statute that is in force, known as UMIFA. Harry's told you about that. And that has been in place in the early 70s. It certainly informed our formation of an investment and a grants and distributions policy back in the early 90s, and we followed it since. In my opinion, the UPMIFA statute is an improvement on this earlier statute, primarily because it clarifies previously existing standards from UMIFA for the investment and expenditure from charitable endowed funds. We have about $200 million on our balance sheet. $190 million of it is long-term or endowed funds. Secondly, it strengthens the concept of prudent investment, which was the beginning of modern portfolio management in the UMIFA law. It offers specific guidelines for those of us who are fiduciaries for the management of and distribution of endowed funds. It applies the rule of prudence to charitable spending, eliminating an outmoded concept of historical dollar value of the original gift. It also facilitates the release or modification of restrictions on a fund consistent with the recognition of the protection of donor intent. Most funds given to large charitable institutions are written with an intention with the donor. So the donor has the opportunity to tell us what it is they want with their funds. Finally, in summary, I believe UPMIFA will give charitable institutions a more precise standard to guide us in investing and distributing funds. And by the same token, I believe regulators and courts will have more precise standards by which to measure prudence, as evidenced by the trustees or directors of a foundation in the event of a complaint or a challenge. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Mullins.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I do have an amendment.
Yes.
And it's the
2022-1238.
Do the members have that? You should have that in your packet. All right. This would be an author's amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair.
This is the Committee of Origins. So Senator Shai moves the 808-1238 amendment as the author's amendment to put the bill in the shape she would like it to be in. Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Master,
Senator
I
Higgins.
Ask a question?
Yep.
Ilii-mosinary
means charitable.
Ilii-mosinary, that's what I said.
Charitable. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hainsworth.
Couldn't we just say charitable?
Madam Chair and Senator, perhaps you could, but after all, lawyers drafted this bill, and therefore you can't expect them to use plain English in a situation where this is a term of art that's used in all these kinds of statutes. And if I might just for a moment comment on these, all these changes were changes recommended by the Minnesota State Bar Association. They had a special review committee consisting of members of the probate.
Say it again.
Section and the business law section. These are the people to be most concerned with this. And these are all very minor technical amendments. What you might say is they Minnesotify the Uniform Act, and so there's really nothing substantive about them.
Well, Mr. Hainsworth and Mr. Mullen, I understand that the word prudent was put in there, both into the title and the sort of a prudent standard. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, did somebody just, was it out of the course of the work, an organic outgrowth of the work that you all did that you decided to?
Well, that's a term of art. Perhaps Mr. Mullen can explain it
Mr. Mullen.
In better terms because he's the one that has to apply it.
Mr. Mullen.
The original UMIFA Act brought in the concept of prudent investing. I mentioned that it's probably the beginning of the modern portfolio theory of management where no longer were you limited to distributing earnings, which was defined as dividends and income off the investment, but you could look at the totality of the investment and take into consideration gains appreciated and unappreciated in the investment corpus. So it started people thinking that we were in the business for long term. We're there by virtue of the endowments, which are long term. So the investment practices that underlie the operation of a charitable foundation like the St. Paul or the Minneapolis Foundation, the University of Minnesota Foundation, when dealing with endowments, has to be long-term, and so it became a standard that was generally recognized, a prudent investor standard. This new act just picks up on the standard that was placed on us in 1972 under UMIFA.
And
I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, I recognize here on page 2, line 28, that it says, and with the care an ordinarily prudent person in a like position would exercise under similar circumstances. So has there been case, I mean, is this established language?
Madam Chair, has there been litigation?
Has there been case law to establish what an ordinarily prudent person is?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is a well-established in case law. This is what you find in all your corporate statutes dealing with fiduciary duties. What your fiduciary are is to be a prudent person, act in a prudent manner. So this is just another version of doing that, bringing it over into the investment field.
So, Mr. Hainsworth, can you give us an example of an instance where somebody violated this standard and it – in a particular case where somebody was found to have acted in a way that was contrary to the ordinarily prudent person?
I can't give you a specific case in Minnesota, but there are lots of cases where, for example, decisions have been made to invest in highly speculative investments, endowment funds, that eat up the fund and therefore or to pay out more than is prudent to pay out and therefore eat up the fund, and so that would be imprudent. And it's the way you frame the question, and if it's ever questioned, anything you do is questioned, it's always in terms of whether you acted with prudence. What was the prudent thing to do? What would a prudent person do in like circumstances?
But the standard for prudence is sort of what the market, right? Kind of like what would the market determine to be, you know, what is generally acceptable.
Yes, but Madam Chair, if you'll look on page 3.3 or line 3.3, and you start looking at the criteria there, the E1A through H, that will give you some specificity. That's what this act does, is to actually give some specificity to what you mean by what factors you should take into account in determining whether your decision is prudent or not.
Very good. Very good. I had not gone that far yet, but I see that now. So that sets the parameters for prudence.
Correct.
Very good. Any other questions for either Mr. Hainsforth or Ms. Mullen? Anybody here in the audience who wish to testify either for or against this bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I just want to make a quick note. I was so excited to see Ilya Mosnary in the bill, because I've had a bill today. Well, we had a bill in the Commerce Committee that had concomitant, and then we had a bill with vexatious, and now I'm on Ilya Mosnary. And I feel like it's been a day of expanding my vocabulary.
So, and I hear all those bills are coming to the Judiciary Committee, Senator Higgins. So, Senator Betzel.
Vexatious is a term we could use here, but what committee had vexatious in its bill? So?
Commerce. Commerce, Senator Betzel.
And, Madam Chair, it was Senator Scheid's bill.
So,
forewarning to the Judiciary Committee. Senator
Scheid.
I would
like to move that Senate File 1406 as amended be recommended to pass.
Any further discussions? Seeing none, on Senator Scheid's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion
Thank
prevails.
Thank you so much.
Members, we are finished with our work for the day.
Can't read it.
However,
that was really helpful.
Tomorrow,
thank you for that.
We have.
That's only one element.
I know. Tomorrow we will start at 9:30 in room 15.
Thank you for coming.
We will go. We have three bills on the agenda, and we should finish around noon, if not earlier. And then we pick up again at 1 o'clock in room 118, because that's the only room that's available tomorrow afternoon. And tomorrow we will be looking at Senator Berglund's Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange Bill, Senate File 3099, and then we're going to be looking at Senator Kubley's Statute of Limitations Bill, Senate File 1096. So the afternoon might get a little bit long.
Treats.
Yes. And Senator Parasol's not here. She is my treats lady.
Right over there.
Oh, she's here. She's here. So that's the schedule for tomorrow.
Madam Chair, what time?
9:30 in room 15. And then in the afternoon, we start at 1 in room 118. So, the schedule for the morning? Well, you want to hear the bill numbers?
What bills they are?
Senate File 2597 is Senator Saltzman's bill on teachers' background checks. And then we pick up my two bills that we kicked to the curb the other night. Senate File 2644, the criminal offense surcharge. I mean, that one should go fairly quick, because it just goes straight to the Finance Committee. And then the Criminal Records Private Employers Use Restriction Bill. Again, we took testimony on that bill the other day. Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, with respect to the health insurance exchange, Senator Berglund's bill, are there particular areas that are going to be within our jurisdiction? Do you know yet what those will be, or haven't you made that determination yet at this point?
We have determined the specific areas that will be coming. I can't give it to you right now because I don't have the summary of those sections in front of me. But Ms. Pontius is going to do a summary of just those sections that pertains to the Judiciary Committee. And so we'll flag that once the bill is in front of the committee. And Senator Olson, if you would like to know that beforehand, you know, why don't you touch base with Ms. Garza, and she can help flag those sections for you. Does any other member want to know the particular sections of Senator Berglund's bill before tomorrow? We'll do a summary.
I'd like to be surprised.
Okay, all right, members, thank you. Good work today. Thank you very much. The Judiciary Committee is adjourned.